Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Today's discussion concerns women's legal rights in relation to social, employment, property ownership, marriage, as well as evolving legislation. And our studio guests are Mrs. Alette Beale and Louise Bick. I will introduce them briefly to you. Mrs. Alette Beale has a BProc and LLM in private law. She was admitted as an attorney in 1995 and practiced for her own account before joining the University of Johannesburg's Law Clinic in 2007 as the clinic attorney, primarily at their Alexandra Law Clinic, then at Doornfontein Law Clinic, and eventually she started the Law Clinic in Soweto in 2011, where she assists people who cannot afford private attorneys. Louise Bick is a director at Werksmans Attorneys and head of pro bono law. She specializes in consumer rights, disability rights, children's rights, property rights, and corporate governance for non-profit organizations. Additionally, she established the Free Werksmans Consumer Protection Law Clinic in Diepsloot, north of Johannesburg. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Legislation promotes and protects people's constitutional rights. However, gender equality and the elements that women confront when they're dealing with issues pertaining to law is still a major concern. And because of this issue, we've got numerous policies and frameworks in place for women, ranging from both international as well as regional and national instruments. And some of those include the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action in 1995, the Commonwealth Gender Plan of Action 2005 to 2015, which is the basis for gender justice conferences, the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, the African Union's Solemn Declaration on Gender Equality in Africa in 2004, and the Southern African Development Countries Declaration on Gender and Development. In terms of legislation milestones and developments that have been established in the last few years concerning women, what areas have you experienced specifically in the work that you've encountered, whether that comes from violence and harassment, family law, inheritance, succession, socioeconomic rights, property ownership, and consumer protection?
What I've seen, there's not that many new acts and regulations that came into operation. There is a draft bill out, and I think that's been out since 2010 or 2011, for the empowerment of women. But if we go back and we look at the Constitution...
Is this going on for the likes of the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality
Yes,
Bill?
It is that bill. But currently it's just a bill, so it means it's not legislation yet, and we cannot really enforce anything written in the bill. I think the basis of that bill lies in the Constitution, with what you just said. The Constitution says we all need to be gender equal, etc., and there should not be any distinction made amongst people because of race, gender, etc. And that is what the bill actually looks like it's trying to do. It's to enforce what's written in the Constitution. But unfortunately, the bill has not been passed yet, and I don't know of any other specific legislation related to women per se. Some of the legislation would contain stuff that would cover both men and women, but not women per se.
I think in commenting on the new bill with respect to women empowerment, what is interesting is that there hasn't been a fantastic reception to this Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill from the women's rights sector. There's been comments from many different human rights-based organizations on the bill that criticize the bill and its contents in that it is just policy. It's not practical enough. It's not looking at actual issues that people like us are dealing with in law clinics, in legal aid environment, in actually empowering women to experience that level of legal protection and rights. To give you some examples, the Legal Resources Center has criticized the content of the bill. There's a group of the people dealing with sex workers' education, Sonke Gender Justice, the Tswaradang Legal Advocacy Center. They've all made comments on this bill to say, hold on a second, are we just creating another policy? Are we just creating another hoop for companies and employers to have to jump through that's not actually empowering massive groups of women within this country, including rural women? They use a very simple definition of gender in this bill. They talk about women and men, girls and boys. And a lot of the criticism is what about a group that doesn't fall into that? What about lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual rights that does cross the gender line? So as much as this bill is one of the new developments, I wouldn't necessarily classify it as leaps and bounds of positive development, in that there are major concerns as to the content of that bill.
I've been quite surprised at the degree of criticism that the bill has faced. I think that the bill is quite open in terms of the content that it does, in order to try to cover as much ground as possible. And let's face it, most bills will never be 100% inclusive of every stakeholder or every population group. But I think that what the bill is trying to do is really make steps forwards and legislative steps for women to try to get to a point where they have that 50-50 equal representation, be it in the workspace, be it in decision-making positions of power. I had a guest from the Women's Department with Children, People and Disabilities, which has obviously now fallen away, and we've now got a new ministry devoted entirely to women. But that seemed to be the gist of what their commentary was, and about establishing the bill. They started in from about 2010 to start building on it and to promote equal opportunities. And there's various segments. There's obviously from a social aspect, there's an educational aspect, there's training and development, looking at how to uphold things on rural women. And where it stands at the moment, I believe, is with the National Council of Provinces. So it's waiting for assent by the president.
And I think even though there's criticism against the bill, it's a good starting point. One needs a basis, and the basis would normally be the bill. If we just look at the Children's Act, how long that took to come into operation, of the Laurie Fraser case, where he fought for his child who's to be adopted by strangers, literal strangers, not by the mother didn't want the child, didn't want to keep the child. He wanted to adopt his child. He didn't have parental responsibilities or rights or anything. And if you just look at where that started from and how long it took for the actual bill to become legislation, that was the starting point. So in order to get to the end, you need to start. And maybe this is what this bill is going to give us, regardless of criticism.
And in your experience, you've mentioned this case with the Children's Act coming through. How long typically does it take for legislation to become enacted?
Well, I think that's a very controversial question. And
how long is a piece of string?
And it will give a very controversial reply. It depends on obviously all the stakeholders, because once the bill is written, it gets published for commentary and for people to give criticism against it, and then it would go back with certain suggestions, and it might be published again after that. So that process in itself can take a few years, because then it will go back to a working committee, the Law Commission will have a look at it again, and then again another draft might be coming out. So that's where the hold up sometimes is, or mostly is.
But what is interesting is that in that process, it creates a lot of debate. And as you've said, the benefit of a bill of this nature is that it's putting the issue on the agenda. And it's saying, let's start a discussion. Let's think about how should the issue of women empowerment and gender be dealt with in society. And the fact that the participation of societal organizations has been so strong is very positive, in that people are really talking about it. People are really starting to think, okay, well, how can we make this work? What are the practical ramifications? So from that perspective, the fact that it does take long also means that there's a lot of time to really go through the issues and iron out what is going to be the practical application.
So this is a piece of legislation that's still to come. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Chaka Chaka, the United Nations Goodwill Ambassador on Malaria in Africa. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence.
We're talking about women and legal matters with Mrs. Beale from the University of Johannesburg Law Clinic and Ms. Bick from Werksman's Attorneys. Let's look at some of the legislation that we already have in place that is specific to women. So one aspect that comes to mind is about customary law and customary marriages. And if you could give some examples of some of the work that you've encountered in the clinics that you run.
The clinic situation is, as I think I've divorced half a Soweto at this stage, but the divorces were done in terms of our Western law, South African civil laws. Not, and those are people who did not just register a civil union. Those are people who actually got married in terms of our acts, and they've got to get divorced in terms of the Divorce Act.
So they've married under Western law?
Yes.
And in order to have the marriage annulled or divorced, they again have to go through on Western law.
Yes.
So that creates a conflict with what happens on a customary level. Is that right?
It does. And it sometimes looks as if people choose between the two sides of the laws, of which is the one they want to use. But because it's a properly registered marriage, they've got to use the Western laws. But then you also get it where the woman divorced the man, but in terms of her culture, her children belongs to her family, or the children belong to the husband's family. And then you look at again as okay, well, which laws do we apply? And then they often choose to go the customary way, where the children would remain the husband's family's children, and they would need to deal with their homestead, the property, regardless of what the divorce law says, in terms of they need to deal with something else in a different way, in a customary way. So it looks as if there's a tendency to swing things by choice. Which law do we want to be applicable?
And when you're talking on a customary level, so to have a marriage and to be divorced from the marriage is one area. But then we've got aspects which come into play in terms of property rights and inheritance and ownership. What are some of the scenarios that you've encountered in that regard?
I think we both have encountered quite a few problems regarding property.
Well, please share your examples.
The normal rule, as I said, the customary one would be that it belongs to the homestead, to the husband's side. If the woman gets married and when he dies, that would go back to the family. But for instance, the woman would get along very well with her in-laws. And they would say, okay, it's fine, you choose what you want to do. We won't choose for you. We won't arrange a step in the place of your deceased husband. We will let you choose what you want to do. Do you want to keep the property? What are you going to do with the children? But normally when there's people not sitting around the same fire, and they say, okay, well, now we're going to enforce customary law. We don't want you to have this house. Even though you're married in community property in the West, in terms of Western laws, we don't like you, so get out of the house. And that's what often happens with the conflict between the Western law and the customary law as well. I don't know if it's the same experience with
you. Yes, the experience for us, Worksmans runs pro bono law clinics based in Diepsloot and in Braamfontein. So the people that we're seeing at our pro bono clinics often live quite a hybrid of values. So they'll come with a customary law background, and I even find that with my colleagues. I mean, we often hear of some of them having their white church wedding and their traditional wedding. I think our society is unique in that there is a hybrid of values. But when you apply it in a legal context, what Alette mentioned about conflict of interpretation becomes quite severe as far as the legal consequences. So In our practice at our Worksmen's Clinics, we see customary law as a secondary issue in property and largely property and inheritance disputes, because under the South African laws of intestate succession, your status changes whether or not you're a spouse. And if your customary marriage was perhaps not properly registered under the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, or you were in the process of paying labola, but it hadn't yet been recognized by the family, there's a murky area where that status of being a spouse is not clear. And that causes a lot of dispute, as Alette said, between families, but also between the practical understanding of this is my possession and I've been living in this house, and the legal understanding of this is my possession and I'll be living in this house. And I'll give you a very quick example. You'll have a couple that have been living together in a house as if they're married in terms of custom. You know, they possibly haven't fulfilled all the requirements of their traditions, but they are seen as a couple. The house may possibly only have it might have been registered to the two of them together, but when one of the spouses die and the other isn't recognized as a spouse, that property goes to his last remaining relatives under intestate succession and not necessarily to her. So it gets to our law clinic in the space of an eviction, in that the woman, who considers herself to now be the full owner of the house because her husband has died, wants to evict the people living in the house. Who are the people living in the house? Her late partner's relatives. Now what do you do? You've got the property law aspects of what legislation says, and you've got the customary practical situation where this woman has been living in this home for her whole married, well, what she believes to be her practically married life. And that's where you have a disjuncture. That's where you have this sort of gray area of, well, you know, there's the letter of the law, but then there's also the practical reality of this hybrid value system that we live.
So spousal recognition is obviously a very important component, and it's clearing up these murky areas when people decide to formalize a union. Who are they supposed to approach? Do they register marriages, or do they register a customary component, or register that they are recognized as having a spousal relationship, so that come down the line when you're facing these types of issues, that the law is in the person's favor and it's not a hindsight point of view or a taken for granted or an assumption that somebody had, I am the spouse, so this is these are my rights.
My advice normally to the people is to register the customary union. Then you've got something on paper, because very often the Lobola letter gets missing. The Lobola letter is something that the families write the agreement down. But very often it's really a piece of paper that got torn off like a diary or from a book or something, and that's the Lobola letter. And some of them I've seen like they were, the ink started fading.
That's virtually disintegrating.
Yes, and the paper is disintegrating. The paper is so soft it feels like toilet paper. So my advice would be to those people to register, that not just be to be recognized as a spouse, but in order to have some standing so she can lay claims to things that would have been difficult to prove otherwise. And I think the problem there is or the answer to the problem is to educate the people. It's a problem very often of educating them, because the people don't know the consequences of things. And I've heard it where the people tell me as well, but I trust it. And I'm not going to write this in paper because of the trust relationship. And that's why many rural and customary marriage, even though they do the white wedding thing, they don't think about the fact that what they're actually doing would be estate planning. And then there's no such thing as trust in estate planning. You're just making life easy for the people who remain behind to have a look at your estate. Because these people often don't have much, but they have a house. And it's family and extended family who lives in those houses. And it becomes, they call it family houses. And that's where the problem comes in. When the people start fighting, the one puts up a shack at the back, the deceased husband's son, he says, but this is my property, and he kicks his stepmother out of her bedroom because he wants to put a duck shop in there or something like that. And the question is eventually, even though this property might have been jointly registered in the husband and the wife's names, he's the eldest son, and he says, I've got the right to this property. Now you've got to weigh up the question, which rights are the strongest? Are we sitting with property rights, which is a very strong right, or are we sitting with the customs? And I think education might be key there.
I think just to add, this issue of trust as being the basis of interaction in society versus law being the basis of interaction in society. And one of the things that I often struggle to explain to the applicants for legal aid that come to our clinics is that the proof that the law requires is a very different standard to the trust that is done in practice. So to elaborate on that, one of the things about gender rights is that there's often issues of intersectionality with other areas or grounds of discrimination. So one of the times where this is a huge hurdle to overcome as an attorney is where the woman that you're dealing with is very old. So you've got the ground of age and you've got the ground of gender coming together to create a far more vulnerable situation. If the person got married by customary law 50 years ago, she's going to tell me that her witnesses to her marriage have passed away. She's going to tell me that, as you say, that scrumpled piece of exam paper or piece of a diary has been lost because they were evicted from their house 10 years before and their property went missing. So the longer after the fact of having to prove it, and because of that stringent requirement of proof rather than just trust, we see this secondary gender discrimination where women are older as well. And it's, unfortunately, it's quite difficult to get around, because Now you've got to explain to a court that every person from the leadership of the community have passed away, the partner or husband has passed away, and the woman now stands to lose her home. So it's quite a, as has been said, it's quite a difficult
situation.
Area.
Yeah.
It sounds as though education is a critical element which is lacking. And I think, you know, for most people, when they unionize and they decide to get married or have a relationship, it always all sort of blue skies and butterflies. And people don't think about the consequences. They don't think about what could happen, what the end result is. And as you mentioned, there's a big difference between trust in relationships and trust in the law. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, an ambassador for the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka every week on this day at this time.
We're talking about women and legal matters with Mrs. Beale from the University of Johannesburg Law Clinic and Ms. Bick from Werksman's Attorneys. What are your thoughts in terms of how to improve education, how people can become more aware of their rights and knowledges? And Mrs. Beale, we spoke briefly, you'd mentioned that, for instance, in Soweto, which is a population well in excess of 1 million people, that there's only two legal clinics available. Yeah, so resources are a significant issue.
Absolutely, because we often litigate against each other. They will be the plaintiffs or the applicants. We will be the respondents or the defence on the other side, and the next day you will turn it around. But the problem is many attorneys, we litigators, we bulldogs. So you see there's a case, you start fighting the case. And we forget sometimes, that especially in rural areas, that there's a community. They often form a community forum, and who helps them to address certain issues, to address certain disputes. I think we have a duty as attorneys who deal with cases like this to educate the people and not just simply give them advice or just tell them you can or you can't and off you go.
So almost, I put this in terms of more of a relationship as a approach as opposed to a transactional approach. So you deal with extenuating circumstances surrounding the case and looking at more holistic solutions as opposed to just looking at the diagnosis.
Louisa's got something to say, but I just want to add quickly that we should maybe make it a ripple effect. Instead of starting small and let the ripples go outside, maybe start with a bigger ripple, like a broad education, and then narrow it down, then to the elders of the people that you're dealing with, then to the community, and that will eventually spill over to the individuals. So it's not just legal advice, it's to just advise them in general. If this is the situation, this is what you can do. Look at your wills. Look at the way you get married. Look at the way you have paperwork, because as Louise mentioned, the evidentiary burden, which is often very difficult if you need to litigate in the courts, because they need to understand that if something ends up in a court of law, the court might decide to apply customary law or the Western laws, and that's the way. By taking judiciary notice of the customary law but applying the Western law. So it's a very fine play, but I think the education with the ripple effect, we all need to take it upon us, especially the pro bono people, because we don't work and we don't earn fees per hour like normal attorneys do.
So just driving it also from having leadership within the community and utilizing community leadership to filtered down to the rest of the people in the society.
I do agree with that approach, but I also think that we need to be far more creative in the way that we are disseminating information, particularly to women. And as I said, particularly to older women. I can't tell you how many of my older female clients are illiterate or can barely read. And, you know, that's the undoing of a long legacy of, you know, gender inequality in education itself. And I mean the ideas that there are out there, you know, you've got an enormous amount of people receiving social grants. There's this huge database of people who fall within the means test of pro bono legal services. This is the exact market that we're speaking to. there must be some kind of a way to get legal education out there using perhaps the back of your social grant slip or on bread packaging or on milk packaging, or on something that are essential things that people are purchasing, that people are in any event being exposed to, and having that information available in some way. You know, it's almost, and I'm not being patronizing in any way. I can really speak from experience. I'm getting married in 2 weeks' time. You're so worried.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You're so worried when you're going through that change about all of the unimportant stuff, the fluff, and, you know, the traditions, but you're not thinking about the status change. You're not thinking about legally you're becoming a whole new entity entering into this relationship. You're not thinking about a will. You're not thinking about, we better make a will together or whatever that needs to be done. And I think maybe the service providers in those industries could be a point of access for that information. So perhaps the women in the community who are known to make the traditional dress for that wedding could have a poster up or flyers to say, register your customary union. And I know that I sound very idealistic, but I do think we need to think of other ways to get information out, because right now I'm not completely convinced that people have very much awareness of what their rights are. And because it's such a sensitive issue, and because it is so gender-based, we've got to look at a way of getting the information out, in particular to the women who are being affected by the issues.
I think that's a very important message, especially from a communication point of view. You're listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kilohertz on the 31-meter band. We're talking women and legal matters with Mrs. Alet Beal from the University of Johannesburg Law Clinic in Soweto and Ms. Louise Vick from Werksmans Attorneys. In our previous discussion, we were talking along the lines of the need for education for women to start being aware of unionizing their marriages, whether that be on a customary level or in a westernized level. We also spoke about the differences between the trust relationships, both from a personal perspective as well as within the law, and the implications and the consequences thereof. Ms. Bill, you run a clinic in Soweto, and you also do a lot of teaching within the clinic in terms of educating University of Johannesburg students. And you'd mentioned that this is from a perspective of being able to empower young women when they're faced with real-life examples and situations. Can you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, I'm going to take it one step back. If we have had a look at our statistics for the law student profile, and there's more women currently than what there used to be studying law. So in the law clinic, we're sitting with final year law students doing their practical of the subject applied legal studies. They need to consult with the clients themselves. I oversee the process, but I'm not part of the consultation. I'm also not in the consultation.
So this is their practical application?
Yes. So, and we're sitting with quite a few women who's studying law and who ends up with in my clinic. What then happens is we often consult with the elderly community or with older members of the community at the law clinic with regards to law problems. And sometimes it's not really a law problem. But because of customs, the younger girl is supposed to keep quiet and listen while the client, which is normally the older man, is talking. The problem then comes in that you sit consulting for hours at end, 2-3 hours, for a simple, possibly divorce consultation. And the younger girl does not know how to interrupt without sounding or thinking she's sounding rude.
So is she having a conflict between her cultural upbringing and her professional
Absolutely,
work?
Absolutely they do. And because I actually started questioning the people who's having long consultations, I asked them, why are you taking so long? She said to me, ma'am, I've got to keep quiet, I've got to listen, because if I don't, I'm rude and I'm not allowed to interrupt.
I think just to give some context, you know, when you are consulting in an access to pro bono services space, there are always too many clients and too little time. So you're always sitting with a room full at your law clinic of clients waiting to see you, which is why being productive and being effective with your time is so important. And I often, you know, people often think that attorneys who are attracted to the pro bono space or the human rights sector are very soft, that they you know, they care about their work, they lawyers that aren't sharks, you know, with this exception to the rule. But the truth is, you actually need to be very tough in pro bono. You need to be very hard, because often people are coming to you with issues that are, as you say, they're not necessarily legal issues. They might be social issues, cultural issues, emotional issues. And often, by the time the client comes to you, they've been to 5 or 6 other places that have referred them on, who hadn't had the toughness to say to them, I'm sorry, you don't have merits, you don't have a case, your matter's prescribed, it's the end of the road for you. So, you know, to be effective with your time when you're consulting in the pro bono space is absolutely essential. And I can understand why you would have had a concern that, you know, your law students are taking so long.
And out of interest, on average, how many clients do you see on a daily basis or weekly basis?
Sure, I can tell you I was at the offices of probono.org, which is another organization that provides legal services, this morning, and they had 16 clients booked for a session from 9 until 12 in the area of the CCMA and labor law, and that's just your average sort of, you know, Tuesday,
CCMA conflict
Tuesday morning
mediating
in the labor arena, yeah. Yeah. So the especially areas for us in particular that are very busy are the housing law clinics, the master's office assistance desks, you know, where people need help with deceased estates, maintenance, domestic violence, all of those areas, there is a massive need. And of course, our consumer protection law clinics are very busy.
You've got a huge volume of work. I don't think you'll be out of business.
No, I don't think so.
Because, well, we work for free, so.
No, we will never be out of business.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Balka every week on this day at this time.
We're talking about women and legal matters with Mrs. Beal from the University of Johannesburg Law Clinic and Ms. Bick from Werksmans Attorneys. Ms. Bick, you'd mentioned that some of the work that you do in terms of the research areas, so for instance with domestic violence and also with regards to contraceptive and reproductivity rights, that you've encountered some work across the continent with various NGOs. Can you tell us about that?
So at Werksmans, a great opportunity for our younger lawyers is to get involved with comparative law research studies, which we do not only, you know, to assist on a pro bono basis across the board, but also to allow, and I find very often it's the young female lawyers who come forward with an interest in areas that may not necessarily fall into our corporate commercial services, like contraceptive rights, like domestic violence. So we did a really interesting study.
Those are social issues that she's experienced. So that's absolutely probably her motivation for pushing that agenda.
You couldn't be more correct. So usually, and obviously very much in confidence, but I have had situations where the attorney who might spend her day in banking and finance or in business rescue and recovery is really impassioned by domestic violence because of a friend's experience or a family member's experience, and on that basis, you know, they like to get involved in these projects because they're learning, they're doing something valuable, but they're also applying their phenomenal research skills that, you know, that we've got incredible resources and they really get to the bottom of these issues. So insofar as the domestic violence work, we've done a recent comparative law study which spanned basically across the world, where we looked at the South African policy and legislation around domestic violence for a Chinese-based NGO that are lobbying to the Chinese government to implement something like a Domestic Violence Act. And what is really interesting when I look at the South African structures, you know, we really do have amazing policy, but it's often in the implementation of it that things become unstuck, which is, I suppose, coming back to the beginning of our conversation, why a bill like the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill must be so, you know, it must be controversial, it must be debated, it must have comments and have people thinking about how it's going to work in practice. And then recently we did a study for the Center for Reproductive Rights, and we looked at the South African policy rights around contraception information and access to contraception and reproductive rights. Again, you know, for me, working in a corporate commercial law firm, even though I'm in the pro bono space, I don't often have a case come to me where there've been a denial of access to contraceptives or a case of forced sterilization. You know, you don't often, probably because of lack of education around those issues, but you don't often have cases like that come to the people who can help, you know, to access those rights. So looking at it from a research perspective is very interesting, because you also open yourself up to a whole new area of need for education and empowerment as well.
Education seems to be the underlying area of this conversation, that people are not fully aware of their rights or what their entitlements are, and where to take issues to if they face a circumstance or situation. In closing today's discussion, I'd like you to tell us about or provide some words of wisdom or hope to women listening on the continent to the show.
Well, I think if we just have a look at the bill that's been in the draft form for quite a while, I think there's a good starting point for us to develop more skills, for instance. And we need to empower ourselves by not just sitting back, but we need to be the women we are. And with that, we are strong people. If we just think how we're juggling households, a profession, children, manage your husband's business often, we can do this. It's not impossible. Empower yourselves, get knowledge, and do what you can with who you are.
I think for listeners of the show, people in an information age, there is just so much that you can access. And at the same time as a woman, at the same time as we love to follow people like Kim Kardashian on things like Twitter and social media, I think don't be shy to extend your reach. Don't be shy to look at organizations like Sonke Gender Justice, the Tswara Nang Legal Advocacy Center, the Women's Legal Center. You know, they're putting information out there, and it really is about saying, I have this special status as a woman. It's something that we must embrace and empower ourselves through, and say, unfortunately, most men already feel empowered. And for women, we've got to take that step forward and say, I'm going to actively empower myself. I'm going to actively know, you know, find out. Have a number of your phone in case of emergency, of sexual violence. This is the number that you call. Be able to disseminate that information in a way that is, you know, it's personal, that you can say to someone, I'm sorry to have heard what happened to you, but look, I've done some research, here's a number, here's someone who you can call, follow them on Twitter and see what they say about your options available. I think empowerment is about taking basic practical steps to be out of the dark on subjects that affect you, particularly because of your gender.
Thank you. I think those are very apt words to end the show. So thank you to Mrs. Alet Beale from the University of Johannesburg's Welcome. Soweto Law Clinic, and to Ms. Louise Bick from Werksman's Attorneys.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band.